Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
As it turns out, Bully Boy Distillery is part of a long history of distilling, brewing, and drinking in Boston. And we've come to J.J. Foley's Pub in Boston's South End to talk about that with Stephanie Sharrow. She's the author of the book Drinking Boston, A History of the City and Its Spirits. And hi, Stephanie. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
So what inspired this project?
Well, I think that if you go to a publisher and the publisher says, how would you like to do a book on drinking? The answer is, of course I'd like to do a book on drinking. When do I start? And it turned out to be a great project, except there wasn't quite enough drinking. There was a lot of research. This is something that I spent a lot more time in libraries than it did at the pubs. But there are a lot of stories that I picked up in a bar, and there's a lot of material that totally surprised me about the drinking history.
Well, let's talk about that. But since we're sitting here in J.J. Foley's, let's just start right here. So what is special about J.J. Foley?
J.J. Foley's has a long relationship with the people at the Boston Herald. And I was a reporter at the Boston Herald, a reporter and editor for about 12 years. And this is a place that traditionally we used to gather on Thursday nights. Long time ago, you used to cash your paycheck here. And this, to me, was the essence of being in Boston. This, to me, really felt like the place where, to pick up a real cliche, everyone knew my name. The pressmen were here. Politicians would wander in. I met Mitt Romney here right after he was elected. He came and was buying drinks for everybody, which was really impressive for a Mormon, so I made it a point to be here. And Jerry Foley, the bartender, will tell you that it never closed a day during Prohibition, and you'll try to get an explanation how, and he gives you this flinty look and says, it never closed for a day.
That's a claim to fame. Let me ask you about something you wrote. You write that Boston has a long drinking history with patterns that began with the city's founding and continued through its revolutionary period and into the 19th century. And what I find fascinating about this is it seems right to me, but it's also at odds with this Puritan history and this idea of banned in Boston.
That is one of the threads, this duality between the effort to impose morality, to create the city on the hill, and a sense of free expression and free spirits. It was interesting that the Puritan fathers, like the Mathers, would speak about drink being a gift from God, and they certainly indulged themselves, and yet they were constantly warning against drunkenness and lasciviousness and other bad behavior. But there were a number of times in which actual court sessions were held in bars.
Really? In bars?
In the bars. Judge Sewell, who is one of the judges in the Salem witch case, he writes in his diary of holding court in a place called the Blue Anchor. So there are many occasions when you had legal procedures actually going on in the bar. So they were quite active in the civic and social life. At the same time, there was this pressure about behavior.
Well, moving post-revolutionary period, you have a great quote in here from Thoreau, which I just loved. He says, the tavern will compare favorably with the church. The church is the place where prayers and sermons are delivered, but the tavern is where they take effect.
Don't you just love Thoreau? He also liked drinking, too.
I didn't know that about him.
Well, I think he saw right through the hypocrisies of some of the puritanical attitudes there. I mean, what struck me about the rise of Prohibition is that there was a lot of drinking at some of the private clubs in Boston, which where the Brahmins went, which was okay. What they didn't like was the drinking in the Irish pubs or in the Italian pubs. So there was a kind of a social segregation between the places where we drink and the places where they drink.
One of the great things you do in this book is you describe some of these great old bars that are no longer with us. And I want to talk about one in particular, or get you to talk about one in particular. This is the bar called Third Base, as in the last stop before home, presided over by Michael T. McGreevy, known as Nuff Said McGreevy. And this was a bit of a shrine for those first Red Sox fans in the city, right?
It was considered one of the first sports bar, if one of the first, if not the first. And we have to point this out for all you fans out there. When the Dropkick Murphys brought back Nuff Said McGreevy's favorite song, The song is called Tessie, and it was sung at Fenway Park. That's when the Sox finally broke the curse and won the series. So I think that's an important thing to point out.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. There's a detail about Red Sox history I did not know. So this book, it's about the history of drinking in Boston, of course. It's also a book full of some great cocktail recipes. You scatter them through the book. You include one in particular that I want to talk about, the Ward 8, a cocktail that's really part of Boston myth. Tell me about the Ward 8.
Yeah, the Ward 8 is an enigma wrapped in a mystery and served with a twist, as I say. But the Ward 8 was a drink allegedly invented in Boston about 1898, and it's associated with a very, very shrewd politician named Martin Lemasny. And the drink was concocted at Lockober's, which is now no more, in his honor. The drink, which is basically a whiskey sour with grenadine in it, became very popular. And it used to be called the drink that would make a girl forget her mother's advice.
That's great. So you write about this drink. It's great. You say, if the Freedom Trail symbolizes the American Revolution, and if the green monster says Red Sox, then the Ward 8 cocktail represents Boston's drinking history. I love that.
Well, I think that's correct, because it is something that there's a lot of mystery to. I mean, I remember when the first draft of the book, I mentioned it once, and by the time the book was finished, it had its own chapter, because I kept finding out amazing things about this drink. And that's one thing that is quite interesting. A lot of people think that cocktails emerged during Prohibition, that they were used to cover up the bad liquor. And while they were very popular during that period, many of these very classic cocktails were created way before Prohibition, so that they have a long history that goes back to late 19th century.
Well, speaking of Prohibition, let's talk about that, because as you write in the book, that when we think about Prohibition, we like to think about Chicago and the gang wars and Al Capone, but of course, Boston had to survive the Volstead Act. What distinguishes the Prohibition era in Boston?
I think that the fact that there were so many speakeasies in Boston. I mean, there was one estimate said that there were 4,000 speakeasies in Boston. Before Prohibition, there was only like 1,000 bars. So there's literally speakeasies on every corner. And one reporter described the gin in one place as basically blowing out your stomach, but basically it was very effective, because with one 25-cent drink, you were drunk for the evening.
So. Now, I've got to ask you this. Joseph B. Kennedy, was he really a bootlegger?
Here's the bottom line, and I know a lot of people who hear this are going to disagree with me, because they're going to tell me their grandfather worked as a bootlegger for Joe Kennedy, because I've heard that over and over again. And my answer to them is, show me the evidence of it. In my research, I could not find any evidence that he was involved. Now, having said that, the family was very much involved with the liquor industry, and Patrick Kennedy, Joseph's father, ran a couple bars in the Boston area, so they were very much involved with the whole liquor business. As for Joe Kennedy, I'm not saying he wasn't a bootlegger, but even if he wasn't, to quote another author, everybody else was.
So let's bring this forward to today. In your book, you quote a bartender named John Gertson from the bar Drink in the Fort Point neighborhood, who said, "Bartenders don't serve drinks, bartenders serve people." It's a quote that I love. What is the bar culture today in Boston? I mean, what explains how thriving it seems to be?
Well, there's a couple things. One is the whole Cheers phenomenon, which, of course, as we know, Cheers doesn't really exist. There is a bar that the TV show was based on, but
and tourists still line up to go have a beer
there. Yeah, and even though on the inside doesn't look much like it. Now, we also have a new movement in Boston, which is part of a whole national movement of the craft cocktail. People like at Drink and at Eastern Standard and Hawthorne, wonderful bars, where they really take the job of bartending very seriously, not only
sort of the art of mixology.
The art of mixology, the crafting. Like I said, these recipes go back to before the turn of the century, and these people are recreating those old drinks, and then they're creating new ones with new ingredients. And we live in a global culture, so like just as wine became more sophisticated in the American palate, so are spirits. used to be you go to a bar like this and you get a shot and a beer, a Boilermaker, maybe a screwdriver. Now you're having more exotic drinks, but they're made with care. And they taste good. And I'll tell you, that was the best part of the research, was looking into the new cocktail movement. I must say something about that.
All right. Stephanie Shoro is author of Drinking Boston, A History of the City and Its Spirit. Stephanie, thanks so much for talking with us today, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, and cheers.
Hey, this is Chef Ming Tsai. We go to the Women's Lunch Place, which my wife is greatly involved with, which is a fantastic charity. And I go there the night before, brine the turkeys, and then we cook and serve. I bring my kids as well. So they realize that, you know what, you guys got it really good. And to give back and serve women that are, a lot of them are homeless and just are not as fortunate as we are, it really makes the holiday for us.
So when the drinking and dining are over, it's time for shopping? We've got the real story behind the phrase Black Friday. That's next. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.